Good night, everyone. It's so good to be here with you all for this study. We're coming to the end of our study in the book of Genesis, and I don't know about you, I kind of arrived here halfway in. So, you know, I got the... In Brazil, we have a saying that we catch the train while it's running, while it's going. And I kind of got that train while it was already going. But this is one of the most beautiful books of the Bible, and we are right now studying one of the most beautiful stories of the Bible, the story of Joseph. And so I'd like to welcome you all. I'd like to welcome our online community that's here listening and studying and praying along with us. I appreciate very much that we have so many people interested in learning more and participating in fellowship as we study this amazing book. Up to this point, we've been studying, we've been through a lot already, and we've already started the story of Joseph. Really, we're at the end of it. But so that we can recap, we already know that Joseph, he was, you know, at the time, he was the youngest son of Jacob. Then he has his brother Benjamin. He becomes the second youngest, the oldest of Rachel. And he's a favorite of his father. We learned that he kind of tattled on his brothers in a certain moment, and they got angry at him. And we kind of see the dynamic between these brothers, between these men. We then learn that his brothers, in this Machiavellian plan, they sell him off to Egypt. He becomes a slave. He dwells in the house of Potiphar. The Bible tells us that the Lord blesses his hands and blesses everything that he does. He was a good-looking fellow. Mrs. Potiphar, she took notice of that. Because of that, he landed in jail for 3.5 years. He then is noticed by the cupbearer because he interprets his dream. Then he is introduced to Pharaoh, and then he becomes the second in command. And in 1 minute, that's Joseph's story up to this point. And I'm sure that all of you know so much and so many more details than this. Now, this latter part, you know, usually I like to stay on one chapter or even half a chapter sometimes, because that's the kind of person I am. I like seeing the details in what we're doing. But today, it's really difficult for us to stay in just one chapter. We're probably going to go through two or even three chapters of this story. So we're probably going to go from chapter 43. Pastor Carlos, he left off on 42 last week. So we're probably going to go and do 43, 44. And if we have time, and I really want to get to 45, because there are some beautiful lessons in there. We just prayed here locally, but I'd like to pray again for our friends on Facebook. Let us close our eyes and praise. Your Father, thank you so much for guiding us to this moment. Bless us now as we open your word. Please inspire this reading, Lord, and inspire our minds so that we can truly understand your will for our life, Lord, through the story of Joseph and his brothers. Thank you for your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So, previously, I just did the whole overview, but last week we know that Joseph's brothers, they came to Egypt, they left with food, all right, so they had the food, even though they went through some drama. Simeon is where? In prison. Simeon is left in prison. They found money in their bags as they returned to their father. And so you have this conundrum in their life where they don't know if this is something good, if this is something evil. Look at what the Lord has done to us. And that's something that we can relate to, because sometimes we don't know how to interpret things that happen in our life. And this is something that happens in their life. This money that they find in the food bags, this is something that they have no idea how to interpret. Is this something good? Is this something bad? I mean, money is always good, or is it? So they have this happening in their life. They have an order from Joseph. Do they know it's Joseph? They do not. What is Joseph's name in Egypt? Zapnat Paneah. Right? Zapnat Paneah. I might be saying that differently than what you're used to, and that's fine. You know, this is a difficult name, but I usually say Zapnat Paneah. And basically, it's because my little brother watches the movie Joseph almost every day, so I know the lines of that movie, and they all say Zapnat Paneah, Zapnat Paneah, and so that's how I say it. When they arrive back, Jacob sees that they don't have Simeon, and he says, "You've bereaved me of two sons now, you know, Joseph and Simeon." He does not want to allow Benjamin to go back. This happens all in chapter 42. Reuben, and this is really interesting, Reuben gives the assurance, you know, let the lad go with me, let me give assurance for him. Is Jacob impressed with Reuben's offer? He's really not. And here you see how far Reuben had fallen. from his father's grace is because of what had happened in regard to his father's concubine and what Reuben did. And so that's where we leave off on chapter 42. We're going to read the following chapters through in blocks of verses, and then we're going to see what we can squeeze from them. Okay? So the first block of verses we're going to read is chapter 43, verse 1 through verse 10. And now read with me. This is what it says. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back, buy us a little food." But Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, "You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you." And Israel said, "Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother?" But they said, "The man asked us pointedly about ourselves and about our family, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' And we told him according to these words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, 'Bring your brother down?'" Then Judah said to Israel, his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we would have returned this second time." So here are a few things, an overview of these 10 verses. First of all, Jacob is resolute. He does not want to let Benjamin go back. Benjamin is the only son he has left from Rachel, his beloved. It's the only one that could remind him of his beloved wife, Rachel. He does not want to allow Benjamin to go back. Now, from this we see that Jacob was a very protective parent. I don't know what kind of terminology we have in English. I suffer from the same problem as Pastor Carlos in that, you know, English is, I spent a long time speaking Portuguese. So in Portuguese, we say for an overly protective parent, we say that parent or that father, or that mother, they're owls. You know, they're owls because that's how owls take care of their young. So how is it?
Helicopter parent.
A helicopter parent? So Jacob was a helicopter parent, always on top of the situation, right? Jacob did not want to let Benjamin go. I mean, look, he already lost Joseph. He already lost Simeon. They didn't know how Simeon would turn out. They didn't know if he was still alive. So he did not want to let Benjamin go. But hunger knows no compromise. They were hungry. I don't know how hungry you've been in your life. You know, here, I know that we have a lot of people from all over the world watching us, including. So it might be that someone out there has seriously gone through real hunger. Fortunately, I have not. So I can't really say that I understand what they were going through. I've been hungry before, you know, and I'm dying of hunger. And we say that sometimes, but truly, we're not dying of hunger. These people were quite literally facing the danger of death. Death through hunger. And so Jacob, day by day, as the shadow of hunger started encroaching upon this camp with many people, with dozens of, you know, people and many families, and Jacob seeing on their faces the hunger that was coming and the despair of not knowing where the next meal was coming from, what happens to Jacob? He starts wearing down. He doesn't know, well, actually he knows what's about to happen if he doesn't do something as the head of the family. So if at first he was resolute saying, Benjamin is not going, now it starts to wear him down. And finally, Jacob tells him to go back. And I always find this kind of curious, because the way he tells him, this is verse 2, he just comes up and says, you know, go back and buy us a little food. It's as if he's kind of trying to ignore the whole situation. You know what? Maybe a year went by. I don't know how long went by, but you know, just go buy us some food. And the brothers are like, Father, you know, we can't go back. If you send us with the lad, we'll go. If you don't, how can we face that man? How can we face that harsh governor of Egypt? Little did they know who it was. Finally, Jacob tells him to go back. We can't. And Jacob, and this is what we find in verse 5 and 6, Jacob, he says, well, why did you tell him you had another brother? That's a legitimate question, isn't it? I mean, think about it. Why did you offer that information? You didn't have to lie. You know, there's a fine line between lying and omitting truth. You know that, right? There's a fine line between lying and omitting truth. But Jacob here is saying, well, why did you guys create this problem? All you had to do, all you had to do was not tell him that you had another brother. Why would you do this? But you know, the brother's answer was very legitimate. Well, how are we supposed to know that he was going to tell us to come back with our other brother? How did we know that this whole thing would happen? So it is quite a mystery here to them. And Jacob is kind of angry, and I can understand that. Why did you offer this information? You know, when I was a child, with my family, we would come from Brazil to the U.S., and we lived in Canada at this time. And my parents, when we were going through immigration, you know that every immigrant is terrified of immigration, you know? And we were going through immigration, and they would tell us we had to tell a concise story. Not that we were lying, but you don't offer them that much information so that, you know, well, they don't start asking a bunch of questions. Don't make it complicated. Don't make your life complicated. And I was like, well, I can just tell them, you know. And I saw my parents worried because, again, immigration sometimes does come down hard on you. And so here, something similar happened to these brothers. Jacob's saying, well, why did you guys give him all that information? Look at the problem that you made for our family. They said, well, how did we know that this was going to happen? So after all this conversation, after everything that happens here, Judah, he kind of copies Reuben. How? Reuben had given assurance for Benjamin. Let him go with me. Let me be responsible for him. Jacob didn't take it. And here you see the switch in the role from Reuben to Judah, because Judah, he imitates what Reuben had says. Here, this is verse 8 through 10. Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. So here we see that Judah, he takes responsibility for Benjamin. And Jacob accepts that. And down they go again to Egypt. Let's continue. Verse 11 through 14. If it seems that I'm kind of rushing this, it's because in part I am. All right. I think the story is very straightforward. All right. It's very straightforward. If you have, like Pastor Doug said, a small question, that's fine. If you have a comment, a long comment, we can leave that to the end after we finish our moment here. Does that sound fair? So let's just run through the story. There are many deep parts of the story. I won't be able to touch all of them, but there are a few that I want to get to. So verse 11 through 14 says, and their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man. A little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. Take double money in your hand and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also and arise, go back to the man, and may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. In the first part of these four or five verses, we read that Jacob then tries to, well, what can I do to help my sons? And he sends off a little bribe. And I really believe that this must have been heavy on the encampment, on them, because they're going through famine. They don't have that much to spare. Exactly. Do you notice that he says a little? I mean, you're sending gifts to a king, you know, to a governor. You're not sending a little. You're sending a lot of good stuff. But here, they spare what they can. They didn't have a lot. But he feels, and you'll find that in Oriental generosity, you know, and all of this, you'll find that they're very generous, right? So here he's practicing that. He's saying, give some presents for the king. But the text tells us that it's a little myrrh, some almonds, some pistachios. This is, what verse is this again? Verse 14, right? So this is what he says. May the Lord, if I am bereaved, I am bereaved. A little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts, almonds. So they have very little produce. They have money, but money isn't food. You know, I have some friends that are from Venezuela, and Venezuela is going through a very difficult moment right now. I'm sure all of you know kind of what's happening there. And my friends, they showed me a picture of people walking around the street, and I might be totally off on this. This happened quite a while ago. This picture was taken quite a while ago. But some people were walking around with barrels of money. The problem isn't that they don't have the paper money, just that the money is worth so little. And there is no produce. You'll go to the supermarkets and the stores, there isn't anything on the shelves. So they had the money, they have the paper money, but the money is worthless. And actually, a whole wad of money is worth less than toilet paper. And they were saying that it was better for you to use the money as toilet paper than toilet paper itself. So in this case, this is what we're looking at here. They had the money, they had the gold, they just didn't have the food. So Jacob says, go back, double the money, go with the little that we have and try to make this guy like you. Make this guy like you. And then he prays upon them. He blesses them. And in the end, you see this point of, well, dependence on God. You know, and I see this echo through scripture. Here he says, if I am bereaved, I'm bereaved. And you see this in many of the biblical characters. For example, Job says, you know, I came in naked to the world, and I will go out the same way I came. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken, blessed be the name of the Lord. And you see this kind of spirit, this attitude in many of these patriarchs and many of these spiritual leaders because they had dependence on God. Look, Jacob knew up to what point the Lord had brought him. Jacob knew. The Lord has brought me through here and here and here and here, and finally I am at this point. If I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. Did you have a question, brother?
Yeah, he was a helicopter parent, but his helicopter was running out of gas.
It was running out of fuel, and that'll happen to the best of us. That'll happen to the best of us. You know, if there's one biblical character that I really admire for his resilience, it's Paul. You hardly see Paul, you know, frustrated or dismotivated. The closest you'll get is in 2 Timothy where he says that, you know, Alexander has betrayed me. But other than that, you know, we all get frustrated. And here Jacob's at the end of his fuel. If I'm bereaved, then I am bereaved. And that was...
It's like, if I perish, I perish.
Right? And he gives them a last blessing. This is the prayer of a desperate man.
The distance they were going back and forth, do you know?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm sure Pastor Sean could answer that question. Pastor Sean is good at geography. Geography isn't my specialty, but we can look into this, you know. It probably wasn't that close from Egypt to Canaan. I know that when the children of Israel, they left Egypt in their, you know, and they went through the desert, they could have gotten to Canaan in 40 days. It took them 40 years. It was a 40-day trip. But that's with about 3.5 million people, you know, with just a caravan of brothers, I'm sure they could have gotten there faster. I don't know if that was the route or anything, but I don't think it was that far, but it was maybe a couple weeks, you know, something like that.
I think it meets Rachel, it's 450 miles.
How many?
450 miles,
all right, yeah. So there you go, 450 miles about. But again, I'm not the expert in geography. Let's read 15 through 22. So the men took that present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand, and arose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready for these men, for these men will dine with me at noon. Then the man said as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house, and they said, if it is because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may make a case against us and seize us to take us as slaves with our donkeys. When they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. But it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it back in our hand, and we have brought down the other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks. Now again, here they reveal what had happened. They don't try to hide it. They don't try to hide it. In the book Patriarchs and Prophets, it tells us that they suspected that it was a scheme. They suspected it was a scheme to entrap them. I don't know how it works here in the States. In Brazil, You have, like anywhere, good police and bad police. And sometimes you hear stories of where police, they forge evidence. You know, so I've known people who, you know, great people, that you know they wouldn't do this, they wouldn't be using any kind of drugs or anything, but the police stops them and then drugs are found in their cars. They were planted there. So this apparently is what some of these brothers were suspecting. This is foul play. Foul play. And so they're suspecting, look, let's not hide this. Maybe that's what they're expecting us to do. Let's come out, tell them what happened, and bear the consequences. It's all that we can do. At least we brought more money to pay. We brought the money from the first time, and we can pay what has happened. Now, the text tells us that Joseph saw Benjamin, and as soon as he sees Benjamin, he doesn't even talk to them. He tells his servant to send them where? To his house. To his house. They don't know why they're going there. They think, you know, maybe this is it. This is what we had coming. But when they get there, they readily admit all this, and it's interesting what the Lord of the house says, and this is where we read the next verse, verse 23. Look at what it tells us. But he said, "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. I love it how this Zaphnath Paneah, all right, forget he's Joseph. He's Zaphnath Paneah, the governor of Egypt, the most powerful country in the world, also probably the most religious country, all right, because we know from Egyptian religion, there was a lot involved. It's a very complex system of religion, the ancient Egyptian religion. And this governor, he doesn't say, you know, Ra, bless you. He doesn't say, you know, anyone else, Hotep, protected you or guided you. He says, the God of heaven, the God of your fathers, your God, he protected you. You know, that was a clue. That right there was a clue. The brothers could have suspected something. Why is this man who has no reason to, you know, to try to, I don't know, patronize us? Why is this man saying that our God blessed us? Why does he even believe in our God? We'll see in a few verses that the Egyptians were very prejudiced against Hebrews. You know, does that sound familiar? Remember when you get the New Testament, when you have all the whole thing with the Gentiles and they can go in, they can sit with them, they can eat with them, they can go in their houses? Apparently, the Egyptians had the same policy. It was an abomination for Egyptians to sit with Hebrews. But here's this governor, and he is saying that our God blessed us. Does he believe in our God? I don't know. If it were me, I would have been suspicious, to say the least. But let's go on. Verse 24. So the man brought them into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys feed. Then they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, for they had heard that they would eat bread there. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth. Stop right there. Now, everything apparently is going perfect for the for Joseph's brothers. Doesn't it appear that way? Everything's great. You know, we have Simeon back. We still have Benjamin. The Lord of the house said that our God blessed us. You know, he's all goody-goody with us. You know, he's treating us very nice, very well. They came and gave him his present. They bowed down before him. They thought that everything was going great. Maybe God really is blessing us right now. Perhaps that's it. That's not where the story ends. Verse 27, then he asked them about their well-being and said, "Is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive?" And they answered, "Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God," again, which God? The Egyptian God? Nope. "God be gracious. God be gracious to you, my son." Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and wept. I remember when watching the little children's movie of Joseph with my brother, when it got to this point, I remember that Benjamin was the image of Joseph when he was that age. I would always look and say, you know, they just copied and pasted, you know, Joseph, the way they had painted Joseph, they just copied and pasted him in the cartoon here because he looked exactly alike. We don't know if that's true. We don't know how similar they were. Maybe one took after the mother, the other took after the father. We don't know. But, you know, just looking at someone that you love, that you haven't seen for a long time, and having that reunion, that's something deep. That's something touching. And here, Joseph, he can't contain himself with emotion. And he has to step out to cry. Now, we know that these cries, they were very loud. Because at a certain point, it says that the commotion was heard from Pharaoh's house. This is later on. But I can imagine that the acoustics were pretty good. So, this is something very loud. You know, the brothers might be wondering, what did we do wrong? We made him cry. You know, everything was going so good. Why is he crying all of a sudden? They don't know. It's a mystery. The house is in an uproar, you know, because the master of the house is crying inconsolably. But he goes back, he's touched by his brother's presence there with them, and he starts crying. They don't know what's happening. Let's continue. We stopped at 31. Then he washed his face and came out, and he restrained himself and said, "Serve the bread." So they set him a place by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. You know, this is kind of ironic. This is very ironic, because the Jews later on created the policy where it was an abomination for them to sit with or even have contact with the Gentiles. When we arrive in Jesus' day, there was something that was called, let me try to translate this, it was called unclean by association. Not only was it possible to be unclean by touching or consuming, but it was also possible to be unclean by association. Do you remember when we read in the book of Acts that the Lord, he lowers that blanket of food before Peter, and he's teaching him a lesson, you know, about Cornelius and all this? Most people jump over the fact that Peter says, "No, Lord, for I have never placed anything unclean or common in my mouth." And some people just jump over the word common. They just go through unclean. Now, it's very significant that it says common, because common was used, this word common was used for impurity by association. So just by being associated with something that is unclean, I can become unclean. And the Jews had this, the Jewish nation had this policy. Yes, brother? Question.
Do we know the genesis of this Egyptian disdain for eating with the Hebrews?
The beginning of this prejudice?
Where did that start? Do we know?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. But basically, I can guess. And I think any of us could guess. It really comes from the cultural differences, political differences. Actually, the Egyptian nation, they had this thing called Maat. I really don't know how to pronounce it. It's M-A-A-T. And Maat was order. Maat means order. Maat means order, harmony, and all of this. And when they upset Maat, they had their own vision of salvation. They could be, if they were buried in the wrong way, if they died in the wrong way without the honorifics and all of this, they were upsetting Maat, and then they would not go to the paradise. So, I do know that the Canaanites, they were seen as barbarians. They were seen as the children of Seth, right? They were seen as the children of Seth. And as such, they were seen as barbarians, and probably because of this, there was this prejudice. I'm not an expert in the area, again, but that's very likely. And you'll find this across history. You'll find that prejudice is the name of the game with different rules wherever you go. Prejudice is not logical. It's not based on logic. Prejudice is never based on logic, because if it were, that wouldn't exist. So here we find that they are prejudicial. We don't know where it begins. Probably it's because of the cultural, religious, and sociological differences between them. And
yeah, it's also because of opinions which become extreme, which makes things simpler.
That's true. You are very right about that. You know, sometimes we tend to focus on people as, you know, well, that person, I remember this one time, and if you hear this in a sermon that I preach sometime, don't feel bad that I said it here, okay? I'll repeat it. But I remember this one time where my dad told me a story. He was a teacher in a university in Brazil, an Adventist university, and he walked into the office, and this was a very conservative, strict university. So, you know, the boys, it kind of followed military code. The boys, the men, they had to have their hair cut very short. And my father walks into this office, and he sees this young man with long hair, and he's crying inconsolably, and he says, "What happened? You know, why are you crying?" And he says, "Well, this crazy, fanatical school is expelling me. It's sending me away." And my dad asked, why? It said, well, because they said that I have to cut my hair and I don't want to cut my hair. What kind of, you know, backwards, fanatical place is this? And then I remember my dad saying, telling me later that he said, well, you have to be careful how you throw in the word fanatical, because there are all kinds of fanaticals. You have the fanaticals of long hair, but you also have the fanaticals of the short hair. You have fanaticals of pants, you have the fanaticals of dresses, you have the fanaticals of vegetarianism and the fanaticals of carnivism, you know, carnivorism or however you say it. And the real question is, what kind of fanatic am I? And I have to be careful, because the Bible teaches me to be modest. It teaches me to be, moderate. Moderate. Well-balanced. I'm not saying, you know, that we should do some of these. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we have to be careful, because in running away sometimes from one edge, we go right to the other edge, to the other side. And that's not what the Bible teaches us. So you're right. Opinions sometimes, you know, ostracize people. To the Egyptians that were super developed, that were super rich, that were super, you know, superpower, to see these barbaric people living their own way, you know. I don't know if you knew this, but the Egyptian women were very independent. They could hold land, they could hold titles and all this. And when they saw the underdeveloped barbaric countries where women were possessions, that was a big thing. They couldn't believe that happened that way. You know, so I know that was an issue, because I've read that I knew it's an article. So for all of these reasons and more, there was this prejudice against the Hebrew nation. Where did we stop? We stopped at verse 30, the last verse. Then he took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as much as theirs. So they drank and they were merry with him. Now, you know, when I was younger, I used to read this and I used to think, well, why did he do this? Why did he give Benjamin five times? I mean, do you think he could eat all that? I'm pretty sure that the other brothers already got a lot of food. Why is he giving Benjamin so much more? And when you think about it, and the book Patriarchs and Prophets gives us a good clue as to why, he was testing them. Because you see, if this was with him 20 years before, they'd be jealous. They'd be, well, why is he being treated with favor? Why are we here like this, you know? And we're eating just this little bit, and he's getting five times as much as us. So this is Joseph's test. He's trying to discern and see what kind of people his brothers turned out to be. Did these men change? Are they better? Have they, you know, have they repented from their ways? Are they going to treat, is Benjamin in danger of what happened to me happening to him? So he was testing them. He wanted to see if they would be jealous. But here, Evan, and the Bible gives us the clue, because it says, so they drank and were merry with him. They weren't jealous. They weren't angry. They didn't think it was a bad thing. It was a great thing. I have a similar feeling with my little brother. My little brother, Michael, 27. So I say little, you have to bear with me. But Michael is, you know, I call him my little brother because he has Down syndrome. And Michael, even though he's 27, he looks like he's, you know, 15 years old. And wherever we go, he's so charismatic. You know, I really hope that you guys can meet him sometime. They're going to come visit us one day. And if you have the pleasure of meeting my little brother, you'll see that he talks to everybody. He hugs everybody. He loves everybody. And he kisses everybody. We have some of those angels here in Granite Bay. We have one called Joseph. I don't know if you've, Joseph from the story, Joe. And Joe is great. I went out boating with him the other day. He's great. And wherever you go, people love them. When I was a kid, sometimes I felt tempted to be jealous of my little brother. Everyone likes him. Everyone knows him. Wherever we go, Pastor Amin, my father, has, you know, this is his son. Most people didn't know that I even existed. They would say, oh, he has another son? You know, but when you mature in life, you get to the point where I'm glad that my little brother has that. He has that, at least that, you know. I feel happy for him that he is recognized and that people like him and love him. They treat him well. So that's a good thing. And here you see that these brothers, they were merry with him. They were merry with Benjamin. They were happy that he was being treated well that way. Let's go on. I have 26 minutes for two chapters. I don't think we're going to be able to do it, but let's try it. Let's go on. Verse 1 through 5. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money. So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to the steward, get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, repaid evil for good. Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. Verse 6, so he overtook them, and he spoke to them these same words. So Joseph, he's still up to his antics. He's still testing his brothers. He still wants to see what kind of men these are. Now, if at the dinner he was testing them to see if they were jealous of Benjamin, you know, even though it wasn't Benjamin's fault that he was being treated, better than them, now he wanted to see how they would treat him if it was his fault. Will they, be the, I told you so brothers? Would they be those brothers that said, you did wrong, you deserve your payment? Would they be those kind of brothers? So here Joseph is testing them to see how they would react if Benjamin indeed was guilty. And that's what happens. Joseph sends them, he puts this cup of divination. Now these cups were very common. These cups, they were used to prevent poisoning. That's what they believed it did. So it was this blessed cup. Of course, Joseph didn't believe in this. In fact, in the Bible, you never see Joseph claiming divination. Divination is one of the abominations that God later on denounces in the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. So Joseph never claimed the ability or the power of divination. But that's how the Egyptians saw him as. He could interpret the dreams that the gods gave Pharaoh, and the cupbearer and all this. So Joseph was seen as someone who could divine. And so this cup that they thought produced divinations was sent to test his brothers. Let's continue, verse 7. And they said to him, why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servant should do such a thing. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whoever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we will be my Lord's slaves. And he said, now also let it be according to your words, he with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall become blameless. So they said, we would never, it defied logic. Why would we bring back the money that apparently showed up in our sacks, in our bags, our food bags, and why would we steal a cup from your master? It doesn't make sense. I don't know if this has ever happened to you before. Have you ever stood by an opinion or a position or a point that you believe to be totally true? And then in a weird turnout of events, in a strange turn of events, you're completely wrong and you didn't even see it coming? Has that ever happened to you before? And you don't even know where to, in Portuguese we say, eu não sei onde enfiar a minha cara, which means I don't know where to put my face. Literally, I don't know what to do with my face. I don't know. Because that's what happened to these men. They were so sure that they did nothing wrong. Why would they? We have our food. We have Simeon. We have Benjamin. We're going back home. Why would this happen? Little did they know that would be in Benjamin's food bag. Verse 11. Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground and each opened his sack. So he searched, he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Something that I forgot to say about the dinner, they sat down in their birth order, in the order of their age. And here again, they searched the food bags in the order of their age. How did they know? This was another proof to the Egyptians that, Joseph could divine. And this was another, I don't know what was going through these men's mind. If it was me, I'd be suspicious. He calls by our God. Now he knows how old we are. He's preferential for Benjamin. This guy knows something. He knows more than he's letting on, apparently. But they found, pardon me?
And he's making those brothers run the gauntlets.
Oh, run the gauntlets. Yes. I didn't know that phrase, run the gauntlets. He's making them run around. Okay, that's
an. Through all kinds of drill.
Okay, that's a new one for me. Run the gauntlets. I'll use that. He's making them. He's making them jump hoops for him. I knew that one. Yeah. Jump hoops. You see? I'm learning, huh? So he was making them jump these hoops. Verse 13. Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. You see how ashamed they were. They didn't know what to do with their face. This is what they did. They tore their clothes. This was to show their shame, their anger, their frustration. But one thing is very interesting. It says here that they tore their clothes. Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. Now, I don't know about you, if this were my brother doing this, who would I be angry at? My brother. I'd be disowning my brother. I'd be trying to, you know, he did this, not me. It wasn't me. So punish him. Actually, poor Mikey. I did that sometimes. It was his fault. I did that sometimes when it was even my fault. I placed the blame on him because my parents were so merciful to him, you know. So I'd say, you know, he did this. It wasn't me, when truly I had done it. Yeah, Lord, forgive me for that. But here you see that Benjamin apparently is in the wrong. But his brothers, you find no hard words. You don't find them saying, I told you so. You don't find them calling him a spoiled brat. You don't find them even doing anything against him. They're protecting him. They all come back. I'm sure that if they wanted to, they could have let him, just him, go back, and they could go on. They could have done that. That's what the servant had said, you know, and this is what Joseph said. No, far be it from me from doing this. If the only the one who is guilty will be killed, or will be my servant. But these brothers, they come back. Verse 15, and Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that that such a man as I can certainly practice divination? Then Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he, also with whom the cup was found. But he said, far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go in peace to your father. Do you see? I just touched up on this. They could go. They were free. But here you see a very fundamental change that had come over these men in the course of these almost two decades, these almost 20 years. Something had changed in these men. And what follows from verse 18 to verse 34 is one of the most beautiful texts found in literature. Found in any literature. Here you have the love of a brother, a broken heart, just calling out to defend his younger brother and to defend the love that his father, the even preferential love that his father has for the son, and he's defending it. Here you see the change over Judah. You know, and this is comparable. You remember when Peter renounces Jesus, and then that look that Jesus gives him changes his life. That look changed Peter's life. All that Jesus had at his disposal was a rooster and a look. And it changes Peter's life. This is similar to that. At this point, Judah is redeeming himself. Because if you remember, Judah had been one of the main instigators on what had happened. Even though it was Simeon and Levi that wanted to kill Joseph, Judah was the one who came up with the plan to sell him. And so that probably weighed heavily on Judah's heart for all these years. And I find it interesting that you only have the story of one of these brothers in the interim. You know, you only have, from the beginning of the story of Joseph and him being sold to Egypt and all of this, you only have one interlude in the story of Joseph, which is the story of whom?
Judah,
which Pastor Ross studied a few weeks ago with Tamar. So why is it important that the Bible tells us of the story of Judah and Tamar? For many reasons. One of which is not the least, is that Judah is the great, you know, ancestor of Jesus. So it's important that you see the change in Judah. And here we see that Judah is another man. Not prepotent anymore. Not proud. You see a humbled man. And this is what he says. Then Judah came near to him and said, and I imagine Judah groveling on the floor, just, you know, desperate. Then Judah came near to him and said, oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. You remember when Abraham is pleading for Sodom? And Abraham is talking to Jesus and talking to that angel, all right, the angel. He's talking to Jesus, and he says, Lord, please don't be angry at me. What if there are 20? Lord, please don't be angry at me. What if there are 10? And here you see something similar in Judah. Lord, please don't be angry at me. Please don't be angry, because you, who am I? I'm nothing compared to you. You are like Pharaoh. And he says, my Lord asked his servants, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age, who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. And we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father. For if he shall come, if he should leave his father would die. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. For we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me. And I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring me down with gray hair, with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? Judah is saying, look, I can't. I cannot go back without him. Just kill me. Just kill me if that's your decision. And here you see the despair in this man. He's a broken man. Now, here we have the beginning of the next chapter, and I have 13 minutes for this, but this is the chapter that I wanted to reach. Genesis 45. Let me find my little notes here. This is what I wanted to reach. 17 years had passed. Well, many years had passed. Joseph comes down. Judah and his brothers come down. Joseph doesn't know what kind of men they are. He's tested them. He's made them run gauntlets. Did I say it right? He's made them run gauntlets, made them jump hoops for him. And finally, the last test, the worst test, and Judah just breaks down before him. You see, Joseph knew Judah as a proud man. He knew Judah as a scheming man. And you see this. You see this in Judah's story with Tamar. He was glad that he was going to get rid of this woman that was a thorn in his side. You see the scheming, manipulative personality of Judah. But in this story, you see that you see another man. Here you see a humble, shamed, sincere man. Something had changed. And that was enough for Joseph. Because at this point, he sees the fruits of repentance in his brother's lives. After hearing Judah's offer to stay in substitution for Benjamin, and that's the key word here, isn't it? Substitution for Benjamin. He orders everyone to leave except his brothers. And here we have one of the most iconical, famous revelations in history, right? Verse 3 through 8 tells us, then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near. Then he said, I am your brother Joseph, the second time, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. They were petrified. What's happening? Is this real life? Mortified, that's a good word. They were mortified. The ruler, this governor, this high and mighty, powerful man, the second most powerful man in the world, he's saying he's Joseph? Is this a cruel trick that God is playing on us? Yep, looks that way. They remembered at this moment, they remembered their hatred. I imagine that at this moment, Joseph, he takes off the, you know, the wig. He takes off the ornaments, maybe the makeup that they use. I don't know what he does, but he reveals, and it slowly dawns upon them that this man truly does look like Joseph. Up till that point, he was talking to them in Egyptian. Now he talks to them in Canaanite, in Hebrew. It slowly dawns upon them that this is Joseph. And they begin to remember. They begin to remember their hatred, their resentment. They begin to remember his dreams. They begin to remember the plans that they had to try to, you know, let's work a way where these dreams don't come true. And now, oh, the irony of it, because it happened. The dreams happened just like he has said. In chapter 44, you see that they bowed down at least 3 times to him. The Bible is very clear on that. They bowed down at least. You lift your hand, brother.
Yeah, I was going to, but you covered it, though.
Oh, yeah? Okay. So here, these brothers, they start to remember all these things. Their hatred, their resentment, their derision, their mockery of this dreamer, their big plans to prevent him or to prevent God from fulfilling those dreams. They remember all these things. Yes. Is it a question, brother?
Yes, a question.
Yes.
Verse 8, sorry.
Yeah.
He said, I'm the father of Pharaoh.
It's a term. It's a term that was used. The second in command, this prime minister, and we'll find this in many ancient Egyptian scrolls, you'll find that they had many titles. So one of, you know how, for example, our president, his wife is called the first lady, you know, and they also call the president POTUS. And all this, it's titles. So really, a father to Pharaoh is a title that the second in command had. This was a title of power, all right? So Zaphnath-Paaneah, the second in command, the right hand of Pharaoh, he had many titles. First and foremost was, it's like saying the first lady, all right? But here Joseph, he is the father to Pharaoh. Okay, that's what it means. So here you have one of the greatest moments of forgiveness and grace in the whole Bible. Right, this is one of those moments. You know how we say that Joseph is a type for Jesus?
Yes.
In this is a perfect manifestation of that reality. Because here, Joseph, and this is something that sometimes when I read this, it tears me up. Because Joseph, he says, look, you sold me. Look at the inversion. You sold me, but God. You sold me, but God. This is the classic affirmation of God's providential control. Nothing escapes his power. Nothing escapes his control. God is sovereign. God is never taken by surprise. His are the hands that never tremble. These are the two aspects, the two poles that control the ellipse of all events. On one side, we have the evil intended by human action. Men want to do evil things. People do bad things. Satan works out in his own machinations to hurt us. But on the other side, we have a God that is never taken by surprise.
That's right.
We have a God that never trembles. The perfect and corrective will of God. You see, fixing our eyes on this latter part, and this is where one of the lessons for us today is, when we fix our eyes on the second part of a God who controls everything, who is sovereign, who has the course of history of this universe in his hands, that liberates us. It frees us. It gives us the capacity to know that even though they sold God, you tried to sell me, but God had a bigger plan. God had a bigger way. Fixing our eyes on God liberates us. This attitude was supremely manifested by who? By Jesus. When Jesus was betrayed by Judas, did Jesus focus on Judas? No. He accepted the betrayal of Judas without fixating on the betrayer. The cup that the Father has given me. That's how Jesus referred to the event. The cup that the Father has given me. Do you see how optimistic Jesus is? Jesus, he would rather say, look, this is the plan of God. Judas did what he did. This doesn't excuse Judas. This doesn't excuse Joseph's brothers. They did suffer the consequences through 2 decades of feeling horrible, of changing, of seeing their father be a broken man. But here we find that Joseph forgives them. Joseph forgives them. Years had passed until this confusing thread of events had started to make sense. Have you ever seen an embroidery? how it is made. And I used to like seeing, we had this with this small quilt at home. It's really an embroidery that I think it was my aunt that made it. And when you turn it inside out, you can't make sense of all those threads, one on top of the other. Have you ever seen that? And if you try to see a pattern there, you'll go nuts, because you can't. But then you turn it outside in, or inside out, I don't know, you turn it outside, you turn it back to the right way, you'll see the perfect design, the grand design of that embroidery. And that's what we see in Joseph's life. How could Joseph had known? You know, I'm sure that Joseph wasn't jumping for joy when his brothers sold him. He wasn't jumping for joy when he became a slave. He wasn't jumping for joy when Mrs. Potiphar did what she did and landed him in jail. He wasn't happy with all these situations. They could maybe not even make sense. But here, finally, he sees that they tried. They sold him. But God. Twice Joseph insists that it had not been his brothers, but divine providence that had led the apparent disasters. And this comes from Patriarchs and Prophets. Twice Joseph insists that it not had been his brothers, but divine providence that had led the apparent disasters, the tragedies and mysteries of his life, adjusting with each thread the embroidery for the composition of his glorious purpose. God, not chance, not human choices, good or evil, had brought him to where he was. Apparently God was indifferent when his brothers had placed him in the pit, or when strangers sold him out as a slave. Apparently God was indifferent with the lies of the wife of Potiphar, where the lies of Potiphar had landed him in prison. However, each fact in this chain of event could be understood differently than appearances. Patriarchs and Prophets. Yes, brother.
So why do you suppose God put them through all of this just so that there would be grain in this time of famine when God could have avoided the famine to begin with? What's the point to all of this?
Well,
do you have any idea? I mean, it's a tough question.
It's a tough question. I'll tell you that the Bible, can we answer this after we close here? The question is, why did God put them through this? Why did God put them through this, We'll get to it in after we finish here. That's a good question. I think I have an answer for that, but we have 3 minutes to finish, and I'd like to at least read through the rest of the chapter. From verse 9 through 25, look at what it says. I'm going to read quick. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, I'm in the wrong place. This is chapter 45. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all of Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks and your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that you have seen, and you shall hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and after that his brothers talked with him. Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brothers have come. So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. Actually, I think I am going to cut off here. I think that I'll stop in the middle of the chapter. Whoever does next week, Pastor Sean, he can start up from verse 17. We got to remember that, verse 17. But here you see the conclusion of the story. Trust, and this is what I want to tell all of you. There's a lot that can be said here. Of course, it's very hard for us to, you know, squeeze all of the details and all the relevance from this beautiful story. But if there's one thing in my minute and a half that I can tell you that we can leave off with is trust in divine providence gives us or delivers us from despair. First of all, trust in God, it delivers us from despair. Second of all, trust in divine providence prevents us from the victim syndrome. Have you ever seen someone with that syndrome? A victim? Always victimized. I'm the victim here. If there was someone who could play that game, it was Joseph. But he didn't do that. And third, trust in divine providence develops in us a spirit of gratitude. God's in control. He knows best, and I'm sure that he will guide me in the right way. Trust in divine providence humbles us and makes us dependent on God, as seen in Joseph's story. Joseph didn't think that he was great. Joseph didn't say, I became the master of all of Egypt by my own means. No, it was the Lord. It was all him. And you know, in our life, that's really what any of us can do. You know, your merits, the great things you accomplish, the great positions that you have, and the great, that's God in your life. Don't think it's yourself. The talents, the skills, the abilities, the whatever it is, that is God. That is God. And even the bad things. I'm not saying that God does bad things, but sometimes these bad things, they allow us to learn and develop ourselves. Pastor Sean is going to conclude it in a special way next week. I would like to thank our online community for being with us. God bless you all. I'd like to thank the local church also for having a great turnout. We're going to turn off now from our friends on Facebook. May God bless you. I don't know if Brian is back there. Maybe. Well, I could have talked more. It's still going. So, usually, okay, there you go. I didn't know. There, he turned it off. But all right. That question, brother, that's a good question. You could apply that to many situations in the Bible. Why did God allow this to happen? Now, one thing that I can tell you is that I don't think this applies so well to this situation, but in the Bible, in Hebrew, you have this grammatical resource that the Hebrew language allows us. It's called the divine passive. And the divine passive is a grammatical resource used by the Jews to allow us to understand that they understood that God guided everything, but God did not provoke everything. So for example, when the Bible tells us that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, that is written in the divine passive. That doesn't mean that God actively hardened his heart. It just tells us that the Lord allowed that because all things go through the Lord's hands. Now in this case, Sister White, she does have a lot to say on this. When you read, I think it's, I don't remember the number of the chapter, but the name of the chapter in Patriarchs and Prophets is Joseph and his brothers. And it says that had these brothers, had this family remained in Canaan, they had one of two options. Either they would dissipate themselves among the nations and they would become idolaters, or they would exclude themselves so much that they would be unable to give the message of salvation to that land. All right, so it was one or the other. So the Lord in his providence, he sends this family down to Egypt in this time of famine. Now, I don't know, and this is something very difficult. Was it the Lord who intended, who actively provoked this famine? Or was this something that the Lord saw coming through the natural? And you could apply this to anything. Why does the Lord allow forest fires? You know, why are there hurricanes? Why are they happen? You know, they happen. The point is we have been born on the wrong planet. We've been born in the wrong place. Yes, brother.
We talked about prejudice a little bit.
Okay.
I think of the term that Ellen White uses, the matchless charms of Christ, which means the loveliness of his character.
Mm-hmm.
And the loveliness of Joseph's character really comes shining through at the end of this story. I mean, he's a different, when he's a little boy, and growing up with his father,
yeah.
He's a little different. They were very prejudiced of him and very hostile towards him. Very jealous. But that loveliness of Christ through the whole Bible is the one person that's never prejudiced.
Yeah.
You can see that, especially in the New Testament, where he's very fair with everybody.
Yeah. That's exactly
very
it.
Very loving and kind.
So. That's exactly it. Yeah. So you see that Joseph really is a type for Christ. You have two in the Old Testament that are types. It's Joseph and Daniel. These are men that were after God's own heart, I would say also as David. Yes, sister?
Well, picking up from the brother's observation, it's the same thing that happened in heaven. God the Father loved God the Son so much that the devil became jealous.
Jealous, yeah.
How come I'm not part of the meeting?
Yeah. Yeah, I like to put that, the angels, Jesus, when the Bible calls Jesus Emmanuel, God with us, he's not playing around. God isn't playing around with that name. Emmanuel, God with us, is such a reality that the angels had kind of forgotten that he was still God. He's such a good friend. Michael is such a great commander. They kind of, I don't know, I imagine it this way. Satan, you know, why? I'm just like him. Why can't I be included? He was not just like him. So you're right. Friends, thank you for turning out. I think we have, you have one last one, brother?
We can make the last one if you want.
Please.
We've been reading the last couple of chapters about how, about the famine and how about Jacob being sending his sons back down to Egypt because they were afraid of dying because of this famine.
Mm-hmm.
But yet in Genesis 45, verse 10, Joseph is talking about, thou shalt dwelt in the land of Goshen, be with me, your children's children, thy flocks and thy herds. So apparently they had plenty to eat. So what, do you have any sense of what this contradiction is here?
Well, they were shepherds. They were shepherds. Animals have to eat themselves. Animals have to eat. So from what I understand, this famine was affecting their agriculture. There was no grass. There was
corn that they were buying was to feed the flock.
Also, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see that Joseph, the Bible tells that Joseph stocked up on what? On corn. You know, he stocked, that's wheat, right? Or corn. Or, that's what they stocked up on. So, pardon me? Grain, yeah. And it comes to a point, and this is really interesting, it comes to a point where Joseph, in Pharaoh's name, Pharaoh becomes the owner of everything in Egypt. He's the owner of the people. The people sell, because it comes to a point where they don't have any money, they have to sell themselves to Pharaoh. It's really interesting what, I read this book once, where it's a novel of Joseph's life, but it comes to a point where the author gets really into this part where Joseph, he bought Egypt in Pharaoh's name, and everything was paid in corn. So they had flocks and herds, but you know, without food, what are these flocks and herds going to survive on? So they did have these sheep and these cows and everything, but if they died, they would have nothing left, and their form of existence, their I don't know how to say it in English, subsistence. Yeah, it would perish also. So flocks, that's how I understand it. They went to Goshen because it had what the animals could feed on. Really? My wife's telling me that it comes to a point where the Bible is telling us that there were no more grazing fields for the animals. I don't remember reading that, but if she's saying that, I'm not going to argue.